and welcome to Ecolibrium on CKUT 90.3 FM. This is your host, Ryan Young. We have a great show for you today, so stay tuned. We're going to start with a song by Sarah Harmer from her new album, Are You Gone?, which came out last year. And this is the song Squeaking Voices. And this album actually was produced by one of my friends, Marcus Paquin. And I love this song. It's called Squeaking Voices.
I'll be on the side of anyone who hides their pain. Standing by the trees, waiting on an easier thing. Out of the corner of my eye, I'm waiting.
And that was Squeaking Voices by Sarah Harmer from her album Are You Gone? You are listening to Ecolibrium on CKUT 90.3 FM. Welcome to the show. So I thought it would be interesting on today's show to speak to St. Anne de Bellevue Mayor Paula Hawa. And of course, Paula Hawa is a political colleague of mine because I'm on City Council in St. Anne de Bellevue. And have been since 2009. And when I was elected, she was also elected in 2009 as a councillor. But then the next election in 2013, she ran for mayor and she won. And she's been the mayor ever since. And I thought it would be interesting to talk to Paola for a number of reasons, but the main one being that she has a lot of experience finding innovative ways to protect green space in municipalities. And of course, her main experience has been with the town of St. Anne de Bellevue, but she often is sought out by citizens' groups in other municipalities that are trying to protect their forests or their natural areas. And so she seems to be somebody who has quite a bit of expertise and insight when it comes to this issue. So we sat down recently outside on a beautiful spring day to talk about protecting green space and what has helped her in her efforts to protect green space. She has both a law degree and an economics degree from McGill University. And when she graduated in 2001 with her Bachelor of Civil Law and her Bachelor of Common Law, she was actually the recipient of the Montreal Bar Association Prize for highest standing in legal procedure and evidence. She's also been an entrepreneur, a project manager, and a mediator. And she has served on a number of commissions that the agglomeration of Montreal has, including the Commission Revue des Contrats, the Commission sur le Transport et Travaux Publics, and a couple others. So let's hear that interview now.
This is Ryan Young for CKUT 90.3 FM, and I'm here with St. Anne de Bellevue Mayor Paola Hawa, and we are on a beautiful spring day and outside doing a physically distanced interview. And, of course, I'm on City Council with Paola. I'm a St. Anne de Bellevue City Councillor myself. And what I thought would be interesting today is to talk about protecting green space, something that both Paola and I share as a priority politically, and to talk about things that you've learned and, you know, your expertise in law, because you went to McGill and have a law degree from McGill, and we're here on McGill Radio.
There you go.
So so maybe let's go back to, you know, what kind of aspirations, or not necessarily aspirations, but what made you want to get a law degree in the first place when you were younger?
Oh, a law degree. I don't know. You know, I've wanted to be a lawyer ever since I was a very young child. Some people are just lucky that when they're very young, they know exactly what they want to do. And I was just one of those. It was always second nature to me. I don't know. I'm so glad, I'm so honored and privileged to have had a chance to attend McGill University, because it is, you know, I've got to say, one of the top in the world. So very proud alumni.
And do you remember any particular law professor or anything that you discovered in law school that really inspired you?
Well, I had one professor, Professor Glenn, that was it was a complicated subject, if I remember correctly at the time. It was evidence based, and he made it seem so logical, and it was more of a conversation all the time, and always pushing you to think outside the box. And you know, that one stayed in my mind out of all of my professors was Professor Glenn. He's passed away, unfortunately, now, but he was a wonderful teacher.
Now, in the municipal world, being a mayor, and I guess you were elected the first time as a mayor
in 2013 is my first mandate as mayor, and of course before that as councillor, just like you, in 2009. So yeah.
And then, so in the municipal world, obviously knowledge of the law comes in handy, right?
And it does, absolutely it does, and especially when it comes to saving green space, or when you're trying to change something within a municipal administration, it certainly helps to understand what the process is, to understand how to read a regulation, how to develop it, define it, how to apply it. And it also helps in terms of not being afraid and understanding when somebody's trying to push back at you, to understand what the limits of their rights are versus your rights. I'll give you an example. A couple of years ago, when we were trying to save a good portion of Anse-à-l'Homme, We were faced with a promoter who was threatening us with a $36 million lawsuit and tried to sue us both at the municipal level and also us personally as members of council. And if you don't have a law degree, once you get one of those demand letters, you have a tendency to freak out, you know, because it is intimidating. But when you understand the law, you just sort of say, yeah, okay, whatever. And so you can put it in perspective a lot more and understand what your rights are and how you're going to push back and not be afraid. So the law does help very much to understand that aspect of the challenge of trying to save green space.
And municipal law or law, you know, I guess what you call that case law has evolved over time in terms of protecting green space in terms of municipalities and their rights.
Absolutely. It hasn't evolved yet to the point that I, you know, can say that I'm completely comfortable. But I do know that when we started, for example, our first time on City Council in 2009, the jurisprudence was still very much to the effect that developer has full rights, he has full rights to develop the land as he sees fit, and especially in Quebec, because we're very much focused on the rights of the landowner. So in those days, it was very much that. The developers got all the rights in the world. And you see, you know, gradually changes in terms of the judgments that are coming down, and more you're seeing a shift wherein the courts recognize the rights of the everyday resident to a clean environment and the importance of protecting nature and how that works for the social good, for the overall social good. So there you're starting to see now the courts being able to balance those two rights a lot more than you used to before. Before it was really, you know, geared towards the developer. Today it's leveling out, and hopefully in the next few years there are some Superior Court judgments recently that I'm assuming are going to be taken up by the Court of Appeal soon enough, and that will only reinforce that concept that nature is for the common good and the common good trumps an individual right.
When it comes to this belief or this typical approach to this issue where a developer buys this land, mm-hmm. it's their private property. Mm-hmm. Now it seems there is an opening to say, well, it doesn't guarantee you the rights to develop that property.
Well, I wouldn't go so far as not to guaranteeing you a right to develop the property. What you're seeing now in terms of the change in the law is that it doesn't guarantee you the right to exploit that property to its maximum financial benefit. So whereas in the olden days, I'm talking maybe 5 years ago, in the olden days it used to be that when a developer purchased the property, he had the right to be compensated for the maximum value of his property. That means if he was able to put 1,000 units, residential units on that property, and the city was asking him to only put 100, well then you had to cover that delta. You had to compensate him for the delta. Today, you're seeing the shift wherein it's not to the maximum benefit of the promoter. It is what is rational and logical in that specific area. Does it make sense to put in 500 units, or does it make sense to put in 100 units? So that's very good for municipalities, because that means in terms of damages and in terms of liability, while you're looking at smaller sums.
Or even, you know, you have the right to put in one house.
You do. Well actually, yeah, absolutely, absolutely. You could have the right to just put in one house. And one thing that's very important, you know, I said this in 2009 when I first started municipal politics, and at first it was just a theory, and I think today you're seeing it be a bit more tangible. People have to remember that a developer, just because he owns more square footage than you own for your own house, does not mean that he has more rights than you do. A municipality, I'll give you an example. A municipality can tell you where you could put your shed, right? Your shed where you keep your lawnmower and all that stuff. We could tell you how many feet away it has to be, how high it has to be, or tall it's got to be. We could tell you all of that stuff. We could put a whole bunch of constraints on your right to your own property. Well, it's the same thing for a developer. It's just that for the longest time, people have thought, well, if you own, I don't know, 6 hectares, you've got more rights than somebody who owns 3,500 square feet. And that's absolutely not true. There is no such thing in the law. So when I say don't be afraid to go up against a developer and know that you have rights just as much as they have rights, that's a perfect example of it.
So let's go back to the issue here in St. Anne de Bellevue where, you know, some pretty big developments were being proposed mm-hmm. by more than one landowner mm-hmm. in the kind of Lac Saint Laurent eco-territory area that had been identified by Montreal. So what comes to your mind first? Because when you went into the campaign to become the mayor in 2013, you were campaigning to some degree on a certain vision.
Yes, but it started before that. It started in 2009 when I got wind of the fact that this beautiful area here that has a high ecological value was going to be developed. I think where we have the cedar yards, which is probably the most sensitive area, that they were going to be, you know, cut down all those 100-year-old trees, or if not older than that, and replace them with six-story condominiums. That was my first awakening, and that's when I started going to city council and asking what was the plan for the urban plan, and that was my first campaign. And I remember going door to door up here in the north sector of St. Anne's with the map and the urban plan that the then council was proposing, and telling people that this made absolutely no sense and that there could be another way to get it done if we all stood together. And I remember this was, like I said, it was back in 2009, and I remember in going door to door how people were, they agreed with me, but they you could see that they were skeptical. How are you going to fight, or how are we going to fight big developers? Nonetheless, they trusted me that I was going to find a way to fight big developers, and so thankfully they voted for me, and that was my first foray onto city council. And I just want to say that the difference between 2009, when I had to convince people that we could save green space, when I had to go door to door and you know, give that spiel to everybody, to today in 2021. If you ask people today in 2021, should we fight promoters? Should we protect green space? It's completely different. You see that in society. You see that evolution. Thank goodness, you see that evolution. So it's very comforting to see that we're going in the right direction. But all that to say, again, I remember in 2009, I remember actually seeing one of the land surveyors with his little tripod out and all that stuff. And I had asked him as I was walking by what he was doing. And he was saying, well, they're getting ready for the development. And I had said, well, you know, I'm against the development or whatever. And he had said to me, well, you know, it's really nice that you are, but the big boys always win. And you know what? 10 years later, guess what? No, the big boys did not win. The people won. And that's... how much more do you want than that, you know?
Absolutely. Yeah. So I recall, of course, that in that first time we were on city council, we were able to get 34 hectares protected, something, mm-hmm. and it was the cedar yard there that the deer use in the winter. And that was partly based on lobbying the provincial government, because mm-hmm. The provincial government sort of owned it through the SJF back then, Société Générale de Financement, which is now morphed into something else. Mm-hmm. So that was kind of a first step. Mm-hmm. But going into the next election, when you decided to run for mayor, mm-hmm. what were you trying to do then?
I was trying to do the same thing as I tried to do in 2009, when the SJF, the provincial government, protected those 30 hectares. What they also did is they left another 30 or 40 hectares in private hands. And as a matter of fact, they used to own it, then they sold it to private investors. So the next step, stage two, was to protect that next 30 hectares of green space. And now the fight was different, because the fight was with promoters, with private landowners who had purchased it fair and square from the provincial government. So then the fight became different. It's the argument and the way that you approach those two are completely different. You approach the provincial government in one way, and you approach a private promoter in another, because you know that the private promoter, well, it's money that's at stake. Whereas I'm not saying that it's not at the provincial level, but the argument is going to be more about the message that that sends to their electors. So you have to tweak the message, and you have to tweak the the approach depending on who you're dealing with. So I think in a certain way it might have been easier to deal with the developer than it was with the provincial government. It goes faster. It goes a lot faster because, of course, the developer wants to turn a buck. You don't blame them. I mean, they're in business for a reason. But the promoter goes quickly, whereas with the government, they have to, you know, put out surveys and see what the mood is in the electorate and how far they are from the next election. So that could take a lot longer.
And I remember one of the tools that the council ended up using was an RCE, like RCI.
Règlement de contrôle intérimaire. What that does is that it freezes the zoning, it freezes development, and it's sort of a warning sign, a warning flag to developers or anybody else. Look out, we're about to change the zoning on this, so be forewarned. And until we decide to change the zoning, everything is frozen. You can't develop, you can't put a shovel in the ground. It's frozen. And what's interesting, in our case, I think we set a precedent there, because usually before we put in our own RCE up here, people used to think that you could only do it for about a year and a half, just hold the freeze for that long. But in our case, I think it went over 5 or 6 years that we were able to freeze it. You know, I think we pushed the envelope, and it's a good thing that we did, because it's not as if we just sat back and waited for something to happen, or it's not as if we used it as a way to slow down the whole process. But because it really did take us that long to come out with an urban plan, to do the studies that had to be done, be it environmental impact, be it future financial impact, be it traffic, because of course with a new development you can have traffic issues also. So it took us that many years to really do all of those studies. So it's not as if we were just using it as a way to slow down the process, but really doing our homework, which is what every single council should be doing. When I hear of certain councils that just say yes to a promoter without having done their own homework first, it makes me cringe. I just can't believe that in 2021 that anybody would still think that that's okay. That's the 1980s way of doing things, 1960s way of doing things. That is certainly not the 2021 way of doing things. So if any council, before they give out a permit for development, if they don't do those three studies, at least environmental impact, long-term financial impact, and traffic study, well, they're not very serious about what they're doing.
Absolutely. A number of things, I guess, were also happening during that time. Montreal was re-looking at the whole urban plan for the island of Montreal.
Yes.
And you had access to that as well.
I loved that experience. I was the vice president of the Commission sur le schéma d'aménagement. Le schéma d'aménagement, just to give you an idea of how it works, is you have urban plans at the, think of it as an upside down triangle, okay? So at the very local level, very detailed, is a municipality's urban plan. And sometimes they'll have them in PEAs that are specific even within the territory of the city. Then you'll have the city's urban plan. Then you'll have Montreal's urban plan. And then you'll have the schéma d'aménagement, which is a higher up document that is a lot more general, covers a lot more area. And within that schéma d'aménagement is where you identify policies in terms of green spaces, what each sector of the island should look like. And within that, we were able, I believe, 8 or 10 people on that commission, we were able to finally detail what we believe the Island of Montreal should look like in terms of the protection of green space. And within that is, one of the longest running fights green on the Isle of Montreal is Meadowbrook and saving Meadowbrook. And within the schéma d'aménagement was the first time that we actually articulated that Meadowbrook should be a protected green space. So it was a very useful tool. It is also, we also identified Pierrefonds West and its importance in terms of green space. So it was a great, great experience.
And Angel Woods in Beaconsfield?
And Angel Woods, absolutely. Angel Woods, Anse-à-l'Orme, Le Mont-Royal, for example. So, yeah.
And in Angel Woods' case, what sort of happened there legally and with the urban plan? And what was your... Because there was that important court case, right?
Well, there are several court cases with Angel Woods. I believe one of them actually went to appeal recently, if I remember correctly. But actually, that's one of the, that's an example of what I was saying, how the courts have evolved since 2009. That's an example of a lower court recognizing the importance of the protection of green space, and that's another example of a promoter. Trying to sue, I don't remember for how many million, I think it was 19 million or whatever, because he was evaluating the land in terms of its full potential. That means putting as much housing as possible on it, and he lost. So there you go. it's a great way forward.
The other interesting thing that came out of the schéma d'aménagement was the idea of a concept that you could have special spots in a place that is zoned residential or industrial or commercial, but that there could be special spots within there that need to be protected and maybe even connected to another sensitive ecological zone.
Exactly. So there's a note, and within that note, that's the highest ecological value. Understanding that the node is where most of the biodiversity activity occurs, right? So, you know, in our case, for example, the cedar yards, right? So in the cedar yards, you have the deer, and then everything that sort of that flows down from the deer's presence. Well, then you have certain vegetation, and from the vegetation, it means you have certain insects, and so on and so forth. So that is a highly rich biodiverse area, and from there you have corridors. So all of this richness is not just stuck in one little circle. Of course, there are corridors, be it of insects, of reptiles, of whatever, that come in and out of it. So that's why you need to do that that environmental impact study, because you need to identify where those nodes are and where the corridors are. And then what you can do is you can say, okay, well, I'm going to make sure that I'm going to protect the most highly sensitive, highly valued biodiverse areas, and the rest I can maybe permit some kind of development around it, making sure there's a buffer zone between the development and the node and the corridors. And that's exactly what we did with the urban plan in St. Anne de Bellevue. And if I may, you know, just give a tip of the hat to ourselves, we were the first in St. Anne de Bellevue to come up with that concept. Usually what happens is a promoter deposits a plan with the city, and then the city, based from that, not the city, but the promoter, will do an environmental impact study. In St. Anne's, we did the complete reverse of that. And I remember speaking to some of the experts who were saying to us, well, you're doing things backwards. And we said, no, we're doing it the right way, which is let Mother Nature tell us where the higher ecological value areas are, where those eco corridors are. Then based on that information, then we put in buffers, and then we can identify where you are allowed to build, not the other way around. So we were the first to do that, very proud of it. I see now that other cities are following suit, and that's the way we did it. That's part of the way that not only were we able to save, through other legal fights, save a good portion of Anse-à-l'Orme, but the area where you can develop is also going to be very sensitive to its ecological value. We're not going to allow it to impede the ecological value of what remains.
And would you say that, for example, because the city of St. Anne de Bellevue did that, if ever they did have to explain themselves in a lengthy sort of way in a court, mm-hmm. they would be able to point to those studies and that they did their due diligence?
For St. Anne de Bellevue, yeah. Absolutely. I think we approached it in a very objective manner. We did our studies. We made sure also that the people that we hired to do our studies had neither a relationship or prior relationship with either the city or the developer. So we want to make sure that it was as objective as possible. Yes, we did our due diligence. And I guess you were asking me at the beginning, you know, which part of my law training that I was able to use in this exercise. Well, that's part of doing your due diligence as part of being a lawyer. You, before you take on a case, you have to understand all aspects of it, and you want to understand it objectively. And that same approach is what we use, and that same logic is what we used in terms of coming up with our urban plan. So if anybody wants to fight us in court, we were in good faith. We did our homework, and what we were presenting are facts.
Now, there was a case, you mentioned it before, when a developer was suing the city for $36 million or whatever. You know, in the end, Montreal did purchase that land from that developer and protect it as part of the Grand Parc de l'Ouest. Mm-hmm. But up to that point, we were going to court, and we did even apply for a fund from the UMQ. And
that's right.
Can you just talk a bit about that?
Yeah.
And the UMQ is the
Union des municipalités du Québec, which regroups hundreds of municipalities across Quebec. It's a union of municipalities. So they have a legal fund wherein they will help finance any new type of litigation that could set a precedent that would be applicable to all the municipalities across Quebec. And in our case, you know, we were not going to let the promoter scare us away with his $1 million lawsuit. And we said, you know what, we're going to stand up. And if you want to fight us, let's go. Let's rumble. And so the UMQ agreed to help fund some of that litigation. You know, it got settled out of court, obviously. The promoter backed down. But that would have been one of the first cases of a municipality going up against a promoter in that sense, yeah.
Quite often when a citizens group is formed to try and protect a forest, and there's many of these going on these days in Ile Perot and Hudson.
Nice to see, actually.
Yeah. For sure. And on the South Shore, it's sort of happening in so many different places. Mm-hmm. But when a citizens group gets together, often they're faced with a lot of bureaucracy and they're told, oh, well, there's nothing you can do because the developer already has his permit or this study has been done or this phase of the project has been accepted. What would you suggest to a citizens group who's faced with being told, oh, well, there's nothing you can do, and maybe the citizens group doesn't even know where to start?
Well, let me tell you three words that you should always repeat to yourself. Persistence breaks resistance at all times. Persistence breaks resistance. So even if they tell you it's too late, the promoter's a big guy, we've already given out the permit, all that stuff, don't let that stop you. Absolutely don't let it stop you. It is never too late. I told you the story before about the L'Arpenteur was already measuring the place where the condos were going to go, and they told us, you know, it's too late, whatever, but we persisted, and look at where we are today. We've saved the forest. So don't listen to it. Keep on going. If you know in your gut that it's the right thing to do, then keep on going. What is important, I'd like to give you a couple of little steps, because I do speak to a lot of these groups quite often. I get quite a few calls. The first thing that you have to remember after you've decided in your mind that you're going to fight this is to remain polite. There is nothing worse than to have a great argument, a great cause, and somebody starts off with the conspiracy theories or, insults members of council. You just do your entire cause a disservice by taking that approach. You have to remain calm, you have to remain rational, and you have to remain polite. Because if you don't do that, you're gonna lose your fellow citizens, and you cannot fight it alone. You're gonna need your fellow citizens. So you need to keep your credibility. So please, no conspiracy theories, no name calling, and remain calm. So that's the first thing. The other thing is that you have to make sure, you know, I see very often people say, oh, well, we've got a petition of 1,000 names or 2,000 names. Well, let me give you a little dose of reality. Petitions do diddly squat, okay? When they are presented to council, they mean absolutely nothing. It is a piece of paper that the council will put to one side and say, okay, whatever, we've got a petition. I would much rather have, and you'll get a lot more bang for your buck, if you have 50 people show up at a council meeting than having a petition of 3,000 names. There is nothing like being like boots on the ground and in your face questions. So don't waste your time on petitions. Yeah, they're great to have. Yeah. But they really have, they don't carry any weight. So don't waste your time on that. The other thing I wanted to say is have a consistent message. So you're going to have, you know, 10 people, 20 people who are at the core of this movement, and you're all going to have different opinions and what you should say about it. But you've got to agree on one message that everybody is going to say, that is going, that you are going to repeat it ad nauseum, and no matter which person of those 20 people says it, it's always the same message. You've got to repeat. So decide together what your message is going to be. You have to go to door with that exact same sentence. And you've got to convince people. You have to convince people. And the other thing that's very important is, what is your message? I see one group that have a very valuable message in terms of, they're saying, you know, well, where are the animals going to be? And what about the bunnies or the fox or the birds or whatever? Yes, absolutely, absolutely. That's part of the message. It's very important. But understand that your message has got to speak to a multitude of people. Some people are going to care about animals, some people are not going to care about animals, but you've got to find that one thing that everybody can agree on. It could be in terms of, well, it's going to increase traffic. It could be in terms of, it's going to devalue my own house. It could be in terms of, it's going to devalue my quality of life. It could be, it's not going to reduce my taxes. But those messages speak to a wider number of people than just talking about the animals in the forest. So find that one message that speaks to the majority of people, and then you can create that groundswell. And then all of a sudden, 20 people at the core of this movement become 100 people, and then 200 people. To me, that's the way that you build it.
And is there ever a time when it's too late because a building permit has been given out?
It's never too late. It's never too late. Even when you've got the shovel in the ground, and I know there's some areas now where there are actually shovels in the ground, and the promoter is actually dynamiting certain areas. Well, you know, maybe you're not going to be able to save 100% of it because he's already, you know, destroyed 20% of it, but you can still work to save the other 80%. So it all depends. At which point do you say, well, it's not worth my effort anymore? You know, is it one acre that's not worth your effort anymore? Is it 500 or 50,000 square feet that's not worth your effort anymore? You have to decide. But don't be discouraged because they've already started on one unit.
And there have been court cases or scenarios where I think it was in the Eastern Townships there in Friedrichsburg where... Yeah. Where the building permit had been given out, but then there was an election and a new council came in,
yeah,
and they successfully protected the green space.
Yes, absolutely. And actually, Friedrichsburg was many years ago. Nowadays, you know, I remember when we first started, people told us, well, you know, once you give out a permit, it's a little bit different. But they were telling us, well, you can't change the zoning because then the promoter is going to go after you because, you know, you've just affected his potential profit or whatever. But nowadays, you actually can change the zoning. And councils should know that they have that right. And if they don't know, then they should inform themselves. They should educate themselves. Because the courts now recognize that a council can change the zoning almost at any time. So that's an example, that something that came from Friedrichsburg, actually, that's evolved since then.
They might have to go to court to defend themselves.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. But, you know, if you're a council and you're afraid to go to court, then what are you there for? You know? But, you know, oftentimes what you're going to find is that you're going to have a council that's divided, right? So you've got your pro developer people, then you've got your let's save every blade of grass kind of people. You'll have the extremes, right? A lot of them are individuals that sit as individuals on a council. They don't belong to a party. So in our case, for example, in St. Anne de Bellevue, you have 7 people, including the mayor. Well, each one of us is individual and we carry our own vote. We do as we please with our own vote. So if you see that, if you're trying to get something across, all you need is those 4 votes. So you need to only convince 4 people, not 7 people. So, you know, focus in on which 4 you're going to work on. And when I say go after them, I don't mean in a mean way. I mean go after them in the sense of, you know, repeating your message to them, communicating with them, explaining to them, build a relationship with those 4 people. But you don't need to spread out your efforts. Go for the majority. That's all you need to do. Also remember that it's not just the mayor that has the right to vote. The mayor in these situations, in all situations actually, has one vote that is no more, no less than any other councillor. So don't think that it's the mayor that's making the decisions. It's the majority of the council. So if the mayor is completely pro-development, then forget the mayor. Don't focus your efforts there. Focus your effort on getting those other 4 councillors that will form the majority to overcome the 3 minority votes, including the mayor.
And sometimes when you're on council or when there's somebody, you know, and this is true in any municipality, quite often you get pushback from the employees, right? And mm-hmm. In some municipalities,
sure,
you do.
Sure.
You know, it depends on who are the employees that you've hired.
Yeah.
I mean, I think in general, you don't always, as a politician, take what is told to you by the first bureaucrat as the
as gospel.
Exactly.
No, of course not, because sometimes, you know, and it's good that there's a separation between administration and the political aspect of it, because the political, the council, well, we're the ones that make policy. And we make policy that the administration is supposed to implement. Now, the reality of it is, implementing change requires a lot more effort on the part of the administration than just keep on doing what you do every day, right? So, yeah, of course, change is always difficult for people. Even though everybody says that we want change, we need change. Yeah, well, you know, implementing change, once it's in your own backyard, it's not that easy to do. And it's the same thing with the administration. So they'll say, yes, we agree with the policy, but they're usually not gung-ho about putting in the effort that's required to turn that ship around, to start thinking in a new way and adopting new processes and new ways of thinking. It's not their reflex, let's say. You have to insist.
The financial side of things where, you know, and in Quebec, I don't know if it's different in Ontario or some other provinces in Canada, and it's probably different sometimes in various jurisdictions in the world. But here in Quebec, for sure, municipalities, their only source of revenue other than grants and small subventions from the provincial or federal government is a property taxes.
Of course, of course.
And so there's always that pressure.
Well, there is that pressure, but you know, it is a myth. When somebody tells you we need to develop for tax revenue, please don't believe them. Do not believe them. This is the way it works. You know, I also happen to be an economist. Before my law degree, I had an economics degree. But what the truth of the matter is, for every dollar, if anybody remembers their curves, think of this as what we call the law of diminishing returns, right? So when a promoter first builds, you get a welcome tax, la taxe de bienvenue, you get a welcome tax, and for the first couple of years, you know, your coffers swell because you get upfront money. So yes, it looks like the municipality is making money. But that levels off after about 3 to 5 years. After 3 to 5 years, the amount of money that you bring in that tax revenue, and this is especially true for residential development, the amount of tax that you bring in and the amount that it costs the city to maintain the services and or increase the services because of increased population levels off. So now you're dollar for dollar. After 5 years, between 5 and 10 years, that's where you get the law of diminishing returns really kicks in. And that's where for every dollar that you bring in residential tax revenue, it costs the city $1.12. So it's great for a council that wants to look great for the first couple of years. And then by the time they retire, you've got yourself less money. And then it's like that domino game where all of a sudden after 5 years, it's costing me $1.12. Now I've got to go out and find more development to make up for that loss. So it's never ending. It's perpetuating. So we need to stop believing. And anybody who tells you that they're allowing a massive development, residential development, because they need money, call them out on it. It's just not true. And tell them they're thinking like the 1980s and that they really need to get out there and read some of the newest economic impact and economic theories in terms of residential developments in municipalities. It's just not true anymore. It's done. Forget it.
Not to mention the fact, and I've seen this with my own eyes, when it seems like developers sometimes, when they do the infrastructure work, they often make mistakes, and then it's left to the municipality to fix it later on.
That's another example that we have. So we have one area in St. Anne's, actually, that the developer built in a marsh zone. The area was a marsh, and they went ahead and they built anyway. And mind you, in those days, there weren't the rules that there are in place today. And, move a decade ahead, and in our council, what we're responsible for now, is we have to spend close to $3.84 million to fix a mistake that the promoter made by building in marshland, because our residents, their basements keep on getting flooded, the streets keep on cracking, the infrastructure wasn't put into the ground deep enough, so it keeps on freezing over the winter. So there's an example of, 10 years later, we're spending $4 million to fix a mistake that the promoter did. So tell me, for those 10 years, the amount of revenue that we got is not even close to the amount that it's costing us now to fix it. So talk about law of diminishing returns. That one is a perfect example. A perfect example.
Yeah, you just don't know what's going to come up in the future.
You don't. Well, you do know what's going to come up if you leave the trees alone. That's pretty obvious what's going to come up with that. You're going to get lots of birds and fresh air and.
Do you find with some of these other projects going on off the island of Montreal, where they're dealing with the MRC instead of the agglomeration of Montreal, and the kind of bigger budget that, or at least the bigger political will that Montreal has to protect a lot of these green spaces and now make one of the largest parks in any urban area in
which,
Northern
by
America.
The way, this urban park, the idea of it was born in St. Anne's. Let's just be, we initiated all of that. So I'm very, very glad. I'm extremely pleased that Montreal has taken it under its wing. But let's remember where that idea came from. And that's Little St. Anne's are the ones that fought and pushed for it for 10 years. And it is reality today.
For sure.
I'm quite disappointed to see what's happening in our neighboring MRCs. And I think it's because, it's a big umbrella and there's a lot of individual little cities, and you see the urbanization more and more, it's growing tentacles. It's going more west, more east, more north, more south. And what I see in the west sector of it has got me quite concerned, actually, because you've got a lot of little cities who are now being, courted by developers. And these little cities see all this upfront money from developers, and some of the citizens are not yet aware of what's going on or how to fight these things, so they're just learning how to mobilize. And so I'm very concerned about what I see in the West. I'm not going to name cities, but I would think that most people can read in between the lines and know who I'm, the three or four different cities that I'm talking about, but...
And obviously, we couldn't discuss all this without mentioning the importance of groups like the Green Coalition.
Oh, my goodness. The Green Coalition. My absolute heroes, my mentors. I can't say enough about them, be it Sylvia or David Fletcher. Just think of it. These two, a lot of others also, obviously, but I'm just thinking Sylvia Oltermark and David Fletcher. I remember when we first started fighting for the protection of Anse l'Homme, I remember nights where I was so discouraged and I was almost sick to my stomach thinking, oh my God, tomorrow the Pépin's going to show up or whatever. And then, I would speak to David or to Sylvia, and they were, that's okay, don't give up, very encouraging. And more recently, I was saying to them, as a matter of fact, when we had the press conference with Valérie Plante when she announced the regional park, do you realize that those people went through 40 years of this up and down, this constant fight, this, pull yourself by your bootstraps, you might be discouraged, but go on and fight the following day. Wow, is that an inspiration or what? 40 years of this. So there isn't a square inch of green space on the Isle of Montreal that has been protected, where Sylvia and David have not been the force behind it. So Sylvia, David, Green Coalition, wow. Thank goodness that we have you. You are our angels.
Yeah. Well, thanks so much for talking to me today, Paula.
Well, thank you very much, Ryan.
And that was my interview with St. Anne de Bellevue Mayor Paula Hawa. We recently sat down on a beautiful spring day to discuss strategies for protecting green spaces. Green spaces, of course, natural spaces are always under threat of being developed. And I think Paula Hawa has a number of insights when it comes to protecting green space. She's been the mayor of St. Anne de Bellevue since 2013, and before that, she was a city councillor. She also has both an economics degree and a law degree from McGill University, and has worked as a mediator before. Thanks for listening to today's show. We're out of time, so check us out on Facebook at facebook.com/EquilibriumCKUTMontreal. If you want to email us with comments or suggestions, you can do so at equilibrium@ckut.ca. I'm on Twitter at Ryan V. Young, and I'm also on Instagram at Ryan Young Naturalist. And we're going to leave you with some music from an amazing bass player, Jeff Berlin. I believe it was in 1998, Jeff Berlin came out with the album Crossroads, and on that album, he had a song called Bach. And I don't know if this is actually like a melody taken from a Bach composition, but of course it sounds a lot like a fugue maybe that Bach would have composed, but it's done in kind of a jazz fusion rock style.
Vaccination against COVID-19 is now underway for priority groups. Visit quebec.ca/COVID-vaccine to follow the vaccination sequence planned for your area and book your appointment online. If necessary, you can also call 1-877-644-4545. Once you've been vaccinated, it's important to continue to protect yourself by following the basic...
The global outbreak of COVID-19 has affected all our lives in various ways, and it has notably drawn our attention to the intensified systemic racism and selective xenophobia towards our racialized friends in our Canadian society. It is understandable for each of us to feel anxious about this fatal disease. However, the sentiment of fear does not give us the right or the opportunity to conduct hate crime and to discriminate against our Asians, Blacks, Indigenous, and other racialized friends. It is not okay to associate the COVID-19 disease with Asians, particularly those of Chinese descent. It is not okay to conduct physical and psychological abuses towards racialized individuals. It is not okay to vandalize Asians and other marginalized owned businesses. We must stop normalizing and stop accepting racist conducts and hate speeches towards all racialized communities. Rather, in these unprecedented times of global pandemic, together, we must educate ourselves and others and be eager to understand race, systemic racism, and racial justice in Canada and elsewhere. Remember, whoever, wherever, and whenever we are humankind. We must learn to stand together as citizens of the world for a healthier, safer, and happier community.
CKUT is hiring a spoken word coordinator. Do you have a passion for storytelling and amplifying perspectives outside of the mainstream media landscape? Are you interested in working at a collectively run, independent community radio station? CKUT's spoken word coordinator is a full-time position starting June 1st that is responsible for the coordination of all CKUT's spoken word programming and is part of CKUT's collective management committee. The position is 35 hours a week, pays $18.36 an hour, and applications will be accepted until 9 a.m. on May 3rd, 2021. Please visit ckut.ca for more details. We're looking forward to hearing from you. CKUT is hiring a spoken word coordinator. Do you have a passion for storytelling and amplifying perspectives outside of the mainstream media landscape? Are you interested in working at a collectively run, independent community radio station? CKUT's spoken word coordinator is a full-time position starting June 1st that is responsible for the coordination of all CKUT's spoken word programming and is part of CKUT's collective management committee. The position is 35 hours a week, pays $18.36 an hour, and applications will be accepted until 9 a.m. on May 3rd, 2021. Please visit ckut.ca for more details. We're looking forward to hearing from you.